ABC. For those who don't know what the ABC is, it's an international network of support, anarchy support for prisoners. Basically, there are a few issues that we're like working with, and a few prisoners like that we're supporting as well. Today, we heard that Tony Poole from Gary Mills and Tony Poole was coming over because after about 15 years in prison, like he has signed his parole because you know he has had enough of it and of not recognizing that like he was framed up and that, but he hasn't been able to make it. But you know, like, just like well remembering. And also Johnny Bowden, who is here in Bristol Prison in Portfield, and is a member of the group as well, and who is just like suffering like isolation, dispersion, like incommunication, beatings, and all sorts of things. So you know, like the Bristol Prisoner Support Group is like in contact with him and just trying to break up that isolation that he's suffering. And we're remembering here tonight as well. But yeah, we have Robert King Wilkerson with us tonight. And he's been touring Europe after being touring America and everything. He comes from New Orleans and he's been for 30 years in prison, 29 of them being in isolation, in solitary confinement. We have the monkey and to talk about it. So welcome, okay. Robert.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm staying. Thank you for coming. And thank you for that introduction. And I would like also thank you made this all this possible in this area. I thank God and the people who work along with you. I don't know all of your name, but our deepest gratitude for helping to make it possible. My story is pretty simple. It is not unique. Because I've learned over the years that this is something that is a pandemic. I thought it may have been endemic in my area, part of the world in which I live in. But as I begin to travel and spread out, I see that it is really a cancer, and its tentacles reach far beyond the shores of America. As I said, my story is not unique, but it may be interesting for some of you who never heard it before. So I think I'll talk a little about my story, along with my story of my two comrades, and along with a few other horror stories that you might find interesting. I call them horror stories because you may not believe, coming from America, that you could find a horror not with the way America depicts itself as being a bastion or a champion of human and civil rights. And in essence, it's the epitome of hypocrisy. The horror stories that are so many, you know, I could just reach here, there, and I could really pull a story out that you can consider horrible. But as was brought out by Marty, my name is Robert King Wilkerson, sometimes I'm called King. Legally, my name is Robert King, but that's another story. I do hail from the States, New Orleans to be exact. And I was released out of Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola after doing a total of 31 years in prison and 29 in solitary confinement. Initially, I was arrested in 1970 for an investigation of an armed robbery that had taken place in an area in which not resided in, but having a record, a prior record. It was customary at the New Orleans Police Department, or police department across the nation for that matter. If you had a prior criminal record and if a crime happened, if you live anywhere from 10, 15, 25 mile radius of that crime, then you automatically became a suspect. And even though I had been, I was released from prison more than a year, I still became a suspect. I was, despite the fact that the alleged perpetrator, as identified by the alleged victim, didn't remotely resemble me, I still became a suspect. So, as it was customary, police, they arrested me along with some other people and charged me initially with investigation of an armed robbery. Later, this was upgraded to actual armed robbery. And still later, after having appointed a lawyer, because I didn't have any money for a lawyer to represent me, that is legally, the state usually appointed an attorney, give him a few dollars to represent you, and expect that this attorney will do the investigative work and the type of job that is necessary for a proper defense. Anyway, this attorney wasn't prepared to do that. You know, some are pretty benevolent people, you find, but those are the exception, not the rule. At this time, it was not the exception. And this guy came to me, this lawyer, he came to me and he told me, said that the prosecutor, because I call them prosecutors, but the prosecutor came to him and told him that if I would plead guilty to 15 years, then I wouldn't have to go to trial and face 60 years. At that time, the maximum for armed robbery was 60 years. Of course, since that time, it's 99 years nothing for an armed robbery. But at the time, this was in 1972, it was 60 years. I look at him like he was crazy, you know, when he told me if I would plead guilty to 15 years. You know, and I usually tell people that I talk to, if they would have told me that they would give me 15 months or even 2 years, I most likely would have went for that. The reason why I would have pled guilty to a crime in which I hadn't committed was because it was also customary that once you was arrested for a crime in New Orleans, especially in New Orleans, they would hold you in detention for anywhere from 15 months to 2 years. So I would have plead guilty because they was gonna hold me anyway for about 2 years, so I would have accepted that, but the guy said 15 years, and I said, hell no, no way. You know, so they got angry, and we went to trial. The prosecutor got the victim to revise the testimony as to the initial description that was given immediately after this robbery. And an in-court identification was made during trial. And in the verdict of 10-2, I was found guilty as charged. And subsequently, I received a sentence of 35 years. Then I got mad. And as I usually tell people, I got even. You know, I didn't sigh, I didn't cry. You know, manipulate myself into a position, and I escaped, feeling like a slave. I felt that the only right that a slave have is the right to rebel. You can't get this legally. I also, you know, I understood at the time, I felt it, I didn't understand it. As time went on, I began to understand that legality and morality don't mix, not in a courthouse. Learned later on that you could actually be legally found guilty, but absolutely innocent of the charge. And legality take precedent over morality. This is the way it is in the state. I don't know how it is in England, but this is the way it is in America. And as I say, I escaped. Being in a benevolent mood, I made it possible for 25 other people to escape. Actually, I made it possible for the whole tier, because they had about 80 some, at least 75 people in the area. I made it possible for anybody who wanted to go, go. But it just so happened only 25, including myself, elected to go. And we made, well, our escape, even though mine was short-lived, some of those guys were rearrested that same night. And unfortunately, one of us was killed. I made no bones about, I had no regrets about the fact that I escaped. And matter of fact, I tried it again and again and again, but I said I failed, but that's the story. I don't want to get ahead of myself. But anyway, for the trouble that I caused my keepers, they gave me the runaround. I mean, they just sent me everywhere, all over the place. Even though I was a state prisoner, they put me under federal custody for a while. Then they shipped me back to the state. They just called themselves keeping me in a state of constant confusion. I guess that was their way of making sure that I didn't set up any plans, or they didn't perfect any plans to escape. Nevertheless, I continued and, you know, to try to escape. But they sent me back to the Paris prison, New Orleans Paris prison, where I was being held. And for the aggravation that I caused them, I was charged with aggravated escape, by the way, and they gave me a 8-year sentence for that, and I had a total of 43 years. And I was awaiting my direct appeal on a 35-year sentence. And I was being held in a cell, 6 by 9, probably a little bigger than the average. We call it bathroom over there. You all say toilet over here. But it was about 6 by 9, maybe by 10 or so. And while looking through the bars, there was a small television that was in the hallway. And I noticed there was an interruption in the regular program, and an announcer came on and they showed a live scene that was unfolding. And this scene was, the announcer came on and pointed out that there was a group of, quote, militants that were held up in one of the housing projects in a downtown area of the city, and they were, quote, shooting it out with the police, unquote. So this kind of arrested my attention, and I really got interested in this. And I was stood there mesmerized by the whole scene, and I didn't witness any gunfire from inside, I noticed hundreds of police with all types of artillery. They were literally trying to kill a house. And it would have killed everybody in the house had it not been for the fact that the house had been fortified with sandbags. Nevertheless, the house was still literally cut in half. It was a brick house, too. That apartment complex was literally cut in half where the bullets had entered. By some miracle, all those people inside that house survived. And there were 9 men, 3 women. And I learned that, well, anyway, they came, they arrested them, and They put them in areas where we were. Some few came on in areas of that, and some they made a separate tier and they put some on another tier. The women went to another designated area for women. But nevertheless, we were able to communicate. But I learned from them that there was a group calling themselves the NCCF. It was an acronym which spelled National Committee to Combat Fascism. I didn't know what fascism was. I don't know none of this, but it sounded okay to me if they were doing what they were doing. So I began communicating with some of the Bloods that were on the tier, and I found out that the NCCF was really members of the Black Panther Party. Later on, I learned that the Black Panther Party was, I had heard about the Black Panther Party, you know. Prior to the Black Panther Party, I had heard about the Marcus Garvey movement. I heard about, you know, the efforts of NAACP, National, you know, Association for the Advancement of Quote Colored People and so forth and so on, CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and so forth and so on. Heard about, like I said, W.E.B. Du Bois, the efforts that were made with him, and I had heard about Elijah Muhammad, and later on, Malcolm X, and even people in my own hometown, Deacon for Defense, and, you know, on and on and on. I heard about a lot of people, but I ain't knew anything about the Black Panther Party. Vaguely, I had heard about them, and I learned that the Black Panther Party was constructed in 1966 by two young men, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, both college students in California. And I found out that they drew up plans that I learned was a working revolutionary political doctrine that catered to the needs not only of black people, but poor people in general, including whites in the society, because there were many whites also who were poor in the society. They came up with the 10-point platform program. And the first point was, we want freedom. We want power to determine our own destiny. That was the first point. And I know I wanted some freedom. Of course, I was taking that literally. I didn't understand all the implications, all the ramifications of what freedom really was. And it was some time later that I really understood the ramification of the type of freedom that black people wanted. I learned that despite the fact that that was supposed to have been, and constitution-wise, that is, a declaration known as the Proclamation of Emancipation and so forth, allegedly freeing the slaves in the state, I learned that black people were still not free, that they were subjected to economic exploitation, constant economic exploitation, political deprivation, and social degradation. I learned that the Black Panther Party, feeling despite all those groups that I named, which catered to the civil rights of black people in America, black people did not have freedom. It went on to say we want an end to police brutality in the community. We lived in a society at that time in which the police, they protected some societies, some communities, but they patrolled black communities. They went on to say, we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace. And as our major political objective, a United Nations supervised plebiscite to be held throughout the black community in which black colonial subjects would be allowed to participate for the purpose of determining the will of black people as to their national destiny. As I say, at that time, blacks did not control their destiny. He had other points. We want freedom of all of men held in federal and state prison. They saw, regardless of how remote it was, they saw this as a form of political repression because black people in America were subjected to political repression. They wanted blacks to be exempt from military service. I mean, black people fought in all the wars that America ever had, and some still do. But you could talk about World War I. Even way back in the Civil War, he fought in the Civil War. But we bring it up, fast forward into the future. They fought in World War I, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and all of the other many brush wars that we don't even hear about that America participated in. But when they returned back to the United States, black people were barred from living in certain areas. They were barred from being protected by the very Constitution, or so-called democracy that they fought for in some other people's land. Thousands of miles away from their own homeland, that is. So these was the type of thing that the Black Panther Party put forth this program, this 10-point program. It catered to the repressive state and condition of black people and poor. You know, many people, because the media, they have a tendency to demonize anything, the corporate media, that is, and the system usually own the corporate media, and they have a tendency to demonize anything that they disagree with. They painted the Black Panther Party as being a racist organization, wanting to kill whites. They say that the Black Panther Party was the biggest internal threat inside of America. They played on the fields of the races in doing this. And in doing this, they were able to bring about the demise of the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party as an organization doesn't exist anymore, not in the United States. Of course, yeah, I know some of you heard about the, quote, new Black Panther Party that exists, and I met those clubs. But they're not the Black Panther Party. They're not the original Black Panther Party. But the media catered, like I say, to the fields of whites. They turned the Black Panther Party into, quote, boogeyman. And by doing so, by demonizing, turning the Black Panther Party, you know, into demons or whatever they wanted to call them, or reflect or project, this created a type of apathy inside the community, despite the fact that the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, when they say the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, it not only meant that they would defend themselves against racist attack or governmental attack, if attacked, it also meant instilling in black people, especially black people and poor people. The example was that you can care for yourself. They initiated breakfast program. Kids were going to school hungry each morning. They couldn't really learn anything in school, even though we know the decadent education, because even though, you know, the Black Panther Party spoke of a decadent education, but they said we wanted an education that teaches us the true nature of this decadent society. But kids were going to school, the basic education, they couldn't really learn. Basic education to really go further in learning about true education of this, the decadent society that we lived in, simply because they were hungry, being victim of economics, you know. They were hungry. They couldn't eat. Half the time they was going to school with empty bellies. So the Black Panther Party began feeding them. They opened up breakfast programs all around the state, all around the country, that is. This was a threat to the system. They opened up health clinics. Blacks were denied real, you know, real help. There wasn't any clinics. They opened up health clinics. They opened up clothing and shoe stores. Like I said, and they fed not just kids, but they also fed whole families who didn't have anything. But in doing this, they were trying to teach and instill in them a sense of not dependency, but independence. They let you know, look, you could do this yourself. But at the same time, they were teaching them this in a political manner, letting them know that, look, politics is responsible. I mean, this same government that we have here, the same so-called, I mean, what you see today is the results of the founding fathers sitting down and feeling repressed for so long that they decided to write the Constitution, you know, and the preamble is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable right, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers and blah, 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 from the Constitution of the government, so forth. Well, the Black Panther Party say, well, this is not, it happened then, well, you know, we could do it now, it's not happening for us. We could do this, we could implement. We have taxation without representation here. We can have us a Boston Tea Party. And this is what, as I say, the Black Panther Party was all about. And this is why they became a huge threat. I mean, sickle cell anemia was a thing that was unknown to Black people, even though we learned that the United States government had knew about this sickness and that it affected 98% of Black people way back in 1954. But they didn't make it known. It was the Black Panther Party who made it known in the state first. You know, and this was going against the plan that America had for Black people. And this is why they became the biggest threat. And this is why J. Edgar Hoover set out to do what he did. He set out to decimate the party. And he did it along with the blessings of the American system, along with aid from the IRS, Internal Revenue Service, and the CIA, or the Central Intelligence Agency. The FBI set about to destroy the Panthers. They infiltrated chapters all around the country. They initiated shootout. They just used to pass by like gangbusters or gangsters in the night and just shoot up chapters. We have pictures and films where you could see how they just shot up officers for no reason at all, unprovoked. The infiltration caused internal conflict that caused one member to go against another member, one group to go against another group, being really wise in divide and conquer. These are the type of tactics that they wrote. Not only that, some infiltrators got into the party and actually made it possible for state police, for policemen inside in the area to go in midnight raids or wee dawn or pre-dawn raids and murder members of the Black Panther Party. Fred Hampton was a victim of this. He was a deputy chairman of the Illinois chapter in Chicago. The deputy of that chapter was Mark Clark. FBI agent infiltrated the party. Drug Fred Hampton, drank Kool-Aid, something that he drank, his water. And while he was drugged, police in a pre-dawn raid raided the chapel and just cold-blooded murdered him while he was sleeping. His body was riddled with bullets, and even after he was dead, they stood over him while his pregnant wife watched and just blew his brains out. Mark Clark, he was also killed that night. There was a lady in the house also, a Sister Panther. She was shot. But that's the tip of the iceberg. These are the type of things that was taking place all across America during that time. The people or the poisons who weren't out in society at that time. Yep, J. Edgar Hoover had it that if you were a member of the Black Panther Party, you was a target. Or you were a member of any black group, or any, not just black group, but some white groups also were a target, because we had some of these liberation armies. Don't know if you know anything about it. It was a group that was made up of a lot of races of our people. And they were also targets. All of them were murdered too. sometime afterwards. But these were the type of thing he initiated first with the Black Panther Party. You had the RNA, you had the BLA that derived later on. They too became targets. The ones who were not killed or murdered outright or set up to be murdered, they were set up to be imprisoned for the remainder of their lives. And you have people in prison from the 70s, from the late 60s, because they were set up by Jagger Hoover, head of the FBI, in the system, the American judicial system, working in concert with them. You know, they speak of terror. They speak of 911. In saying this, you know, of course, sure. The people whom I work with, we value life. We understand life. But we also know that there's a time and place for everything, too. But we really value life. When that happened, 911, I speak of for those of you who aren't following me, I speak of September 11th. And the reason why I say 911, because 911 is the code, emergency code in the state. And so it just so happened that September 11th occurred, and that's the way we write it. We say 911-02 and so forth, whatever, 01. But it was 911, and it was that emergency code. I speak of the incident with the bombing of the two towers. People, you know, in across the world, and people in the state, I think they got caught up too much in emotionalism after that. I think not realizing America's past and present domestic policies. I don't even have to talk about American foreign policy, because they have destroyed many towers around the world. But America's domestic policies has been one of sheer terror. You know, I tell people that, you know, yeah, we sympathize with what took place. But terrorism then began on 9/11. It started way back doing chattel for black people, doing slavery. It started way back then when my history book that I read tell me that more than 50 million black people lost their lives during the Middle Passage. And we just come on back, fast forward that into the future. Even during slavery, the terror that many people went through during that time. And even after slavery, Jim Crow, you know, came on the set, which was equal to slavery, you know, and all of repression and the police repression and the systemic repression that I just got through speaking of. All of this is terror. And, you know, 9/11, terror just didn't begin on 9/11. I tell people, you know, and I tell students, college students and young people and not so young and older people and not so older people that, you know, many people believe that America is heaven, you know. They believe that America may have a monopoly on the definition of a terrorism, but, you know, America does not have a definition or monopoly, rather, on the definition of what constitutes terrorism. Because I've learned, and I've come to realize that one man's terrorist, a so-called terrorist, is another man's freedom fighter. I tell people that you might believe America is heaven. Okay, to you, it might be heaven. That's your prerogative to believe that America is heaven. But I tell you that even in heaven, I let them know, some people catches hell, and I let them know that there are black people and poor people in America who catches hell and who have been catching hell, I think, for the longest. And as I say, terrorism just didn't start. It is terror when people are erroneously or unjustly charged with a crime and get a life sentence, especially in Louisiana, without the possibility of parole, probation, or suspension, or sentence. You are told that you will die in prison. You're in a cell, locked up, 23 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's terrorism. That's terror. I mean, and here, my two comrades, Harmon and Albert, along with many people, many other people, we don't just focus. I want you to know we don't just focus on my two comrades, because we've learned. I work with the National Coalition to Free the Angola Tree, and I learned that this issue is pandemic. It wasn't just, at first I thought it was endemic, but it just cuts across the Atlantic, Pacific as well. And, but my two comrades, they are in prison simply because they were members of the Black Panther Party, simply because they dared to struggle in a prison. Once becoming members of the Black Panther Party, they both joined, you know, while they were in prison, and both began to try to effect changes to bring about some type of change in a prison. Way back in 1970, Angola was, state prison was considered the bloodiest prison in the nation. At this present date, it holds more than 5,000 prisoners. It is the largest maximum security prison in the nation. And according to stats and according to the warden, the fastest warden who lawed over the prison, he said that 85% of the people in Angola won't ever get out. And they won't get out because if you don't have a life sentence, you have a practical life sentence. And a practical life sentence means you, if you don't have the alphabet, which is L-I-F-E, you got the numbers, and the numbers are high. There are some people in Angola, and it may sound strange to you, you may not believe this. I know one person in Angola with 2,100 years and about 11 life sentences. There are other people who have twice 99, three times 99, 400, 700 years. These are the type of sentences that are meted out. My two comrades have life sentences, life in 50. The life sentences they have, crime that they didn't commit because, as I stated, they dared to struggle. And they went to Angola during a time when brutality was rampant. It permeated the whole prison system. There were inmate guards. They maintained the security of the prison. They carried the weapons. They engaged in beatings, engaged in killing. They engaged of raping and selling younger inmates when it was convenient. And all of this was done at the blessings of the prison officials. They actually ran the prison when it came down to prisoners. They manned all the towers. When the work line went out, they engaged in chases and everything else if you tried to escape, and they manned all the towers. And they have literally, like I said, killed, but they have literally shot people and got rewarded for shooting people, killing people for trying to escape. Or if you go out the guard line, you don't even have to try to escape. That was the guard line you had to walk by. You here, you walking, he's there. If you step here, boom. This is the type of thing that was going on in Angola at that time. Harmon and Albert, in 1971, they were sent to Angola after having become a member of the Black Panther Party. And they sought for and got permission from UN Newton to open up or establish a chapter inside of Angola. In fact, they did. And Angola had the only prison chapter in the nation. The prison at the time was also segregated. There were different cook shifts. You had one cook, white cook shift was white and one was black. There was a partition down the aisle in a large dining room. People worked, prisoners that is, worked 17 and 18 hours a day. The main crop at this time was sugarcane, corn and cotton in that order. But sugarcane was the biggest crop. They worked for 2 cents an hour. As I said, Harmon and Albert began, they brought a new ideology, the type of ideology, the same ideology that the Black Panther Party had taught them. And guys began listening. They understood, they began to see the true nature of what was going on. They began to see that it was a divide and conquer. If the keeper, if you just do what you did, then, you know, the keeper will maintain the status quo as it is. Everybody began listening. Whites began listening, Blacks began listening. But then, this was a threat to the system. They were holding political classes. There were engaged in work stoppages. A lot of the beating that was taking place stopped. A lot of the raping stopped. And even some of the killing taking place among the inmates stopped. This, too, was against the status quo because the system felt as long as they kept the slaves, white and black, at each other's throat, then they had no, you know, then it was cool. But now when the slaves, you know, stopped feuding among themselves, and he going to probably look for somebody else to feud with. And that's what happened. They were looking for the system to feud with. So the system, they got more angry with Harmon and Albert. Not long afterwards, a young security guard was found slain in a dormitory. The people who became first suspected, Harmon and Albert and two more people, without the slightest of evidence, no forensic evidence, no nothing, they detained Harmon and Albert, picked them up off the area in which they were. This was in April 1972, and placed them in solitary confinement and held them there until they went to court. There were no, as I say, no forensic evidence at all. There was a bloody handprint that was found at the scene of the crime. It was fingerprint also, a thumb or something. It didn't match neither the people who went to trial. There was no fingerprint. There was a single knife that was found. Neither of them print was on the knife that they found and allegedly put in their hands. Say this is a knife that was used. Despite the testimony that one of the person who subsequently testified against Harmon and Albert stated that after Woodfox stabbed this individual, he gave the knife to Harmon Wallace and Harmon Wallace stabbed him. Well, no fingerprints or nothing on it. And this is a knife that was used to convict them with no fingerprints or nothing on it. Later on, Albert even gotten a new trial. Not based on the fact that he was actually innocent or anything like that, but because of an error. I think the judge made a verdict that he knew Albert would be found guilty again. Albert taking a lie detector's test, and he passed this test. As I said, there was no evidence at all linking him initially with this charge, and subsequently in the new trial, there was still no evidence, except the evidence of a prison snitch who was an inmate guard at one time. This guy had a life sentence without the possibility of parole, probation, or suspension of sentence. Had a record, you know, by long as this building is wide. After some days of intimidation and coercion, he was the one who came forward and testified against Harmon and Albert and the others. We have learned since that time that Hezekiah Brown, his name was Hezekiah Brown, that this guy was paid pretty good, handsomely, for his testimony. Now, this may not seem like too much to you, but in 1970, we have letters Sean, and these letters was acquired on discovery. And we have letters that was written by the warden at that time to the Secretary of the Department of Corrections stating that Hezekiah Brown should be rewarded for testifying against Herman and Albert and getting this conviction. One of the rewards was, and the agreement was, he would be paid a carton of cigarettes a week. Now, that may not seem much, you know, to you, but in 1970, a carton of cigarettes a week in Angola, you were living high off the hog, partner, believe that. But that's not all. We also have letters showing that was written by state officials to other high officials seeking clemency for Hezekiah Brown for his testifying against Herman and Albert. We also know that Hezekiah Brown was granted clemency, and Hezekiah Brown walked out the prison. But not only that, without having any support or anything from people on the outside, and this don't seem like, might not seem like much, but in 1970, it was worth about maybe six times what it was now. Hezekiah Brown walked out of Angola State Prison with nearly $1,000 in his pocket. This was the money that he was paid for to lie and implicate Herman and Albert into a crime that never really been solved, and that is highly suspect that is a possibility that with the feuding that was going on inside of Angola among the prison staff themselves, that was a possibility that it was induced by the internal contradiction among the staff themselves. But they had to put this on somebody, and conveniently, you know, after days and days of interrogating and getting someone, you know, to testify and lie on Herman and Albert, they placed it on Herman and Albert. Hezekiah Brown, as I say, went home, and he died. Unfortunately, he died of natural causes. Herman and Albert, they remained in prison, convicted for a crime in which they didn't commit. I'm going to speed up a little bit because time is running out. I know I got too much time. You wonder where I come into the picture at. Okay. Let me bring it up. Bring it up to Paul. At the same time that Herman and Albert was sent to Angola, I also was sent to Angola. I had also become a member of the Black Panther Party after having escaping, trying to escape again and again and again and again and again, and getting more time. I had an open charge on me, and they rushed me back to the New Orleans Parish Prison. This was in November 1971. They returned me to Angola in the latter part of April 1972, 2 weeks after this prison guard was allegedly killed by so-called, quote, black militants. Oh, that's in the record, by killed by black militants. And I was away from prison from November up until April. More than 5 months, when they returned me back, they placed me immediately in CCR, or closed cell restricted. Put another way, in solitary confinement. Matter of fact, they put me right next door to Wood Fox. I learned that the reason why they did this was because they had me on the investigation for that murder of the prison guard. Even though I was 150 miles away, had not been in prison for almost 6 months, had never met the man in my life, and they had me under investigation. Speaking of a rush to judgment, they did me the same way they did Herman and Albert. However, they could not convict me. They would have looked stupid trying to convict me for a crime, you know, under the circumstances of how I projected this. It would have been stupid. But they held me, and one year later, a prisoner was killed on a till in self-defense in the area in which we live. Now, you must understand that in 1970, even though we lived in 1973, which that was the last year it happened, even though we were in solitary confinement, we were in a cell, what you call 23 hours a day and only out 1 hour. What they used to do, they used to just open the door for 1 hour and just get it all over with and just let everybody out in the hall who wanted to come out for that particular hour. And on this morning they did this, or this was the practice at that time. And an inmate was killed in self-defense. They indicted 11 of the 13 people who was out on the till that morning in the area. And he narrowed this indictment down to two people. The guy who had actually killed the person in self-defense, and yours truly, me. We were subsequently went through a real indictment by the grand jury in West Feliciana Parish, and we were subsequently convicted. We were tried jointly, and we both had duct tape over our mouths. We were shackled and handcuffed behind our backs. And we were found guilty. The state also got, despite the fact that the security guard who was on that morning made it plain in his testimony that he didn't see me do anything, that it seemed like it was a fight that took place, that was an argument between the person who actually had killed a guy in self-defense and this other guy. Well, it wasn't, as I said, it was a killing because, you know, these two guys had it on, and one guy up with a knife, and he didn't know the other guy had a knife. He didn't think the other guy had a knife. The guy just beat him to it. But this was Angola at the time. Nearly, it was the bloodiest prison in the nation at that time, even in cells like that. You know, but despite the fact that the officer stated that he didn't see me do anything, they got two people to state that I had participated in the death of this inmate. Despite the fact that of the nine knives were found, blood was found only on one knife. And despite the fact that the report of the coroner stated that all of the wounds were made with the same knife, a jury saw fit on testimony of one of the guys to find me guilty. One of the guys' testimony was so incredible, he was impeached during the trial. But they accepted this of the other guy, even though his testimony contradicted the other guy's testimony. They accepted this testimony, and I was found guilty. And I languished, you know, how we both, and I was given a life sentence, along with the guy who had actually killed the guy in self-defense. And for 12 or so years, I had this life in 43 years. Both guys who had testified against me had subsequently went home, and I was still in solitary confinement, and I received word that both of them really had come back to Angola. But one of the ones who came back stated that he had found gold. His conscience was bothering him. He wanted it to be known that he had lied on me. He said he had 8 months left before he was scheduled to go home. They told him if he didn't testify against me, that he would be given a charge. Under that type of duress, he implicated me. He said they even wrote his testimony out for him. Well, I was glad he found God. I was glad his conscience was bothering him. But anyway, he did up an affidavit to that effect. And shortly thereafter, this other guy who had, well, he was paid for his testimony, who had testified against me, and whose testimony that they really, I believed, it wasn't impeached. He also had returned to prison, and he wrote up an affidavit stating that he was in the shower at the time, and plus he was high on pills. But he is a Vietnam veteran and all that, and ex-Vietnam veteran at that time. And he had been high on pills that, or prison pills that he took, and he was in the shower. And record shows that he was subject to hallucination, a lot of things. But he did up an affidavit also, and he stated that his testimony against me was incredible. He was in the shower, and if you read the report or read the record, the transcript, you would see that he actually was in the shower. Stuff that he testified to, he could not have testified to these things if he would not have been in the shower. But utilizing these affidavits, I went back to court. However, it took from 1987 up until maybe 2000 before a judge actually ruled that I had made a showing of actual innocence. But he went on to say, however, and this is why I told you that legality and morality don't leak the court out there, not a friend. You could be legally found guilty even though you were morally innocent. This federal judge ruled that I had made a showing of actual innocence, but because there was no constitutional violation involved in the trial in which I was convicted, then I could not get the benefit of the ruling in which I went to court on, which was a Missouri ruling. But you have to know something about law, international law, in order to know what this was. But it was a precedent that was set by the United States Supreme Court. And but if I would have to have, it was a hard showing, according to this jury. I didn't make the, while I satisfied one prong of the law, I failed to do so in another prong. But unperturbed, you know, and still fighting for my freedom, still knowing I was innocent and maintaining my innocence. And by this time, I had a lawyer. And he believed in my innocence also. I had a support group behind me who also began to believe in our innocence. Having appeared at certain hearings and so hearing, you know, in my behalf and so forth, this had a tendency to kind of change the judge's mind. That is the three judges, because a three-judge panel who had formally granted me a new trial based on something totally different, but suggested that, you know, this new trial that they granted me be taken away because the law in which they had gave it to me was bad law. So they suggested an en banc hearing, which is all the judges. And on their suggestion, all the judges came and they reversed that new trial order by a three-judge panel who had suggested this. But this other three-judge panel, who had sat on that very en banc court, after this judge had ruled that I had made a showing of actual innocence, some of these same judges came back and said, well, yeah, there was a constitutional violation. He was denied the right to a fair trial. But this was, as I say, done simply because, not because they were so benevolent, but because I had gotten support from people on the outside. And subsequently, and I end this here, save a little time for someone else to talk and maybe question and answer here. Subsequently, on February 8, 2001, I was released from Angola State Prison after doing 29 years in solitary confinement, 31 years total. And since that time, I made a commitment that even though I was free of Angola State Prison will never be free of me. And since that time, I've been stepping on that dog tail. I have been traveling around the states, talking to everybody about my two comrades. I also work with the National Coalition of Freed Angola 3, and we have broadened our perspective. We are not exclusive. We are inclusive. We know that there are prisoners around the nation languishing in prison due to domestic terror that happened more than three decades ago, and we focus on their plights. After going to the other part of Europe, which was Germany, Paris, Belgium, and Holland in December last year, begin to get a much broader focus. I learned that there are political prisoners over there. Coming here, I learned that there are prisoners here. On Sunday, we went to visit Gary Poole and Mills in prison, who we now know is unjustly incarcerated. This is something that is not just happening in America, but it's happening worldwide. But in our state, we understand the growing need for concern, because there's a new type of slavery that exists on the shores of America and is seen in prison. We have the privatization of prison, where people become stock, they become commodities. We have prosecutors, we have judges, we have district attorneys, you have other lawmakers have a vested interest in making sure that prisons are built and that prisons are kept, that they are kept full, and that they make laws to make sure that their money, that their investment is safe. They watch the stock market. Some of these lawmakers, they watch the stock market. They see that prison is a booming business, multi-billion-dollar. They see that it's booming. They see that they can make money. So it's to their advantage to erect laws. And they do it in our state to make sure that you never get free from prison. This is why a district attorney can elect to go for the more aggravated charge or the element of the charge instead of the more mitigating element of the charge, whereby he might charge you with maybe a conspiracy to charge. He'll charge you as a principal and give you a life sentence like he give the so-called perpetrator, because he have money invested in prison. Lawmakers, legislators, you know, people who make the laws, they have if they watch the stock market, if they don't have money invested in the stock market, their buddy got money invested in the stock market. So they're going to do their buddy a favor. They're going to introduce bills and they're going to make laws. Laws that will, if you get arrested, you will go to prison for the remainder of your life. And this is what's going on. And this is why we are doing what we're doing. This is why my focus will remain on prison. And I say it again. Even though I'm free of Angola, will never be free of me. This is my commission, and my commission expires at my death. Thank you very much.